Hey, this is Jesse. On this episode of the podcast, we're featuring an interview with retired Grand Canyon Wilderness Coordinator Mike Kearsley. The interview was recorded by Desert View Rangers Don Thompson and Melissa Panter. You'll also hear from Science and Resource Management Deputy Chief Sarah Haas at the very end of the episode. Enjoy.
Grand Canyon, where hidden forces shape our
ideas, beliefs, and experiences.
Join us as we uncover the stories
between the canyon's colorful walls.
Probe the depths
and add your voice.
For what happens
next at Grand Canyon.
Hello and welcome.
Okay. This is Jesse.
This is Emily.
And this is
Behind the Scenery.
My name is Mike Kearsley. Now I am retired from the Park Service. I do still work a little bit. I work for the Rhodes Scholar Program at NAU, doing hikes with people, showing them the Grand Canyon, Organ Pipe, Saguaro, other places like that. And before that, I worked in the Resource Management Division at Grand Canyon. I started working there in 2007, was brought on to do the vegetation map. I mapped, coordinated the vegetation mapping of the park and parts of Lake Mead that were part of Grand Canyon Parashan National Monument. And after that ended in 2012, I worked on the backcountry management plan. I did mostly impacts analysis and affected environment writing, that kind of thing. And then in 2016 became the wilderness coordinator. And and actually became a permanent employee in 2019. As a wilderness coordinator, one of the duties was working on soundscapes questions, along with minimum requirements analyses, impacts analysis, backcountry campsite monitoring, all kinds of stuff.
So for most people listening, they might not know what a soundscape is. So, and would you want to like explain what that is and what that means?
It's the acoustic environment that you are in. It is the auditory or acoustic qualities of an area, and it's specific to the area, specific to the time of year.
In my program, I talk about soundscapes and I'm like, it's inescapable. You're always in a soundscape.
You're always
contributing to it.
It's one of the intangible parts of the environment that you're in. It's like the like a smell, like aroma.
So when you were studying soundscapes at the Grand Canyon, what exactly were you studying or looking for?
We were mostly doing compliance monitoring for overflights. Overflights are limited to certain parts of the park, and the reason for doing is that they want to limit the amount, the total area of the park that is exposed to aircraft noise more than a certain percentage of the day.
Right.
And so we had our listening stations set up underneath these air tour corridors. So that was the primary reason for monitoring soundscapes.
Yeah. When you're talking about like a listening station, like what do you like, describe that to me.
Okay. It's a setup that has two components. One of them is just an audio recorder, a digital audio recorder that records the sounds. And it's paired with a sound pressure level meter that's a little more technical. It does more or less the same thing, but it breaks the sounds into intervals of the sound spectrum that are 1/3 octave tall or 1/3 octave broad. For each of those intervals of the spectrum, it says it records how much sound pressure there is, the loudness of that sound pressure. So there's those two things, microphones, a solar panel, a big battery pack, And usually we would put a wildlife camera out just to, in case there was something that was happening that we picked up on the acoustic recording and didn't understand what was making it, we could look at that. We recorded some really interesting wildlife stuff. Trespass livestock coming through, horses destroying the solar panels and turning over all of our buckets. It's fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I think on the sound drive, there's a audio of elk licking the foam off of like a SM4, which is pretty funny.
Yep. What is that sound? Well, now that we needed a way to understand what that sound was.
So wait, were you like manning these like listening stations, or were they like you put them up and then loud?
When they first started putting them out in the early 2000s, it was part of the Air Tour management plan that they were putting together. They would do attended listening just to verify what it was that they were hearing on the recordings. But for the most part, no, you just set it up, recorded an audio timestamp. Mm-hmm. You look at your GPS. What's the GPS time? And 3, 2, 1, clap, it's 11:05. And so that way you can synchronize the acoustic recording with the sound pressure level meter. But then you walk away and you don't come back until either you need to service it or you want to download a week's worth of stuff. But yeah, there was very little. We did very little attended listening.
Right on. I was just imagining like a couple of scientists like sitting out, just like really quiet for many hours. And so you were under the flight corridors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this was, are these like air tours?
Air tours, right. They are specific areas where the air tours are supposed to fly. There's one over by Desert View at Zuni Point. It goes right over Zuni Point, goes north. There's another one that comes south that goes over the Dragon. It's a peninsula off of the North Rim and goes over, I think it's Boucher use area, west of Hermit's Rest. And then east-west, that one goes back from the southern end of that, it goes back to the Tucson Airport. At the north end, the Zuni Corridor turns west and goes across the North Rim, just north of the basin.
Did you have stations like all throughout that?
No, just at the southern end of the Zuni Corridor and the Dragon Corridor. And then we'd set one up in the basin to catch those three points, because those are more or less the places where the we saw the most activity, and it's also where you're going to intercept most of the traffic. So,
just because it's my personal curiosity,
yeah.
And I think I'd asked you this before, was that affecting wildlife? And if it was, in like what ways? Or
before the air tours were required to fly more 1,000 feet above the rim. Mm-hmm. Before these air tour corridors were established, they could fly anywhere, and they would typically drop over the rim and fly around below the rim.
Yeah.
And of course you want to see things, and pilots like to point out wildlife. And there was a grad student at NAU whose master's thesis showed that, when a herd of bighorn was, harassed, if that's the word, by an air tour, it stressed them out. They didn't have as many offspring. They didn't have as many young. They were moving around. So after the change to the air tour corridors, that was much reduced. And by putting them up above the rim, I think that also reduced the amount of impacts on wildlife.
Totally. Yeah, I think when Sarah and I were talking, you had like described it like the Wild West of the skies, like before they had the corridors, which
that boggles my mind. When I was 12 years old, I flew from Williams over the rim, and the pilot dropped us down in and flew us all around. Our car broke down in Williams on a big cross-country trip, and That was our way of wasting time while the parts for a Volkswagen bus came up from Phoenix. And the pilot flew us all over the place. And the whole time he was saying, keep your eye out, my buddy so-and-so is up here too, and I don't know where he is. So there was another pilot flying around below the rim. And it was a source of anxiety for sure while we were flying.
Wow. Yeah. Dang.
Yeah.
It's so different now.
Very different. And much more popular. I mean, there's a lot more flights now than there were then. And if you're in Boucher, it's really insane because they're right on top of you the whole time.
I can imagine that would like affect a visitor's or like just anyone's like personal experience if they have like all these flights going overhead.
Right.
When you were studying soundscapes with interns and stuff, like was anything like that measured or like?
No, that took place mostly in a lot of those interviews and studies took place in the early 2000s. They would set up, you know, all across the South and North Rims. They recorded in many different places to find out, you know, what was the impact. And we were just specifically focused on the air tour corridors.
So I know you had talked about some like interns, like when you had interns.
Oh yeah.
Were there any interns who like inspired you or that you learned from? Or
there were a number of them. That was one of the joys of my job, was working with interns who were fresh out of college or out of their master's degree and excited about the work. And the first two we had were Maggie and Hannah, who basically resurrected the program. I had been given the program, which had been dormant since probably 2010, and this is 2017. They found the gear, they got it working, they contacted the regional people from Natural Sounds and Night Skies who came out and helped them put it together, show them how to do it. And basically they set up the program based on what they were trained with. We had somebody come out and do training of the analysis, training of the gear setup, troubleshooting, you know. And because the gear was so old, they got very good at repairing things. You wouldn't think working in resource management you'd learn to solder, but they were all really, really good at soldering by the time they were done. So they were awesome and enthusiastic and ready to go. And actually Hannah works here. She's the hydrologist. She's a physical scientist by training, was a hydrologist and got her master's in hydrology, but did this because it was interesting to her. Who else? Belen was another all-star. She was a funny person who was not trained in soundscape. She was a physicist. She worked on small particle physics and had spent time at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. And only came to do this because the pandemic happened and she couldn't travel back there. And she was really good at coding. She was a coder. And part of the issue I have is that I'm not a coder. I don't understand digital audio files and how to manipulate them. And she took this project on and kind of moved us away from the compliance end of things to looking at the broader questions about soundscapes. I think when we talked on the phone, we talked about acoustic complexity. Complexity comes when you get multiple elements. Think about songbirds in the morning, and their sounds change very rapidly. So one minute, 1 second to the next, or 1 10-second interval to the next, the sounds you hear are very different. The pitch is different, the duration is different, the loudness is different. All those elements go into the idea of complexity. And in an area that just has natural sound, the acoustic environment is more complex because you don't hear the same thing over and over again. In areas where it's dominated by human sounds or it's unpopulated, there really is no complexity there. It's very monotonous. Helicopters going over, they sound the same, you know, for the 2 minutes you can hear them. But, you know, a Tohi or something is a very complex song, and it's, when you break it down, it has a lot of different elements. So the idea is that a complex acoustic environment is one that has a lot of natural sounds and not man-made sounds. Mm-hmm. And she got locked into that. There was a study going on at Sequoia Kings Canyon, long-term study, where they were looking at acoustic complexity in areas that had burned and not burned, and asking, is this, or burned in areas that had been managed for fire and areas that had not been managed for fire. So, you know, big wildfire versus a controlled burn kind of a thing. And she got interested in that question and sort of moved by writing code that would do the analysis. She got the program sort of moved in that direction. And the third one was Maddie Chudzik, that's right. she came to us from the Listening Lab. The Park Service works with Colorado State University to do analysis for parks, soundscape analysis for parks that don't have somebody on site, the expertise locally to do it. And she worked in that lab for all 4 years of her undergrad. It was an REU thing, a work study program. And by the time she was done, she was actually running the lab because the lab manager had moved away. He moved on to something else. And so when she came, she brought all of this knowledge about how the Park Service does these studies, and, you know, didn't need my minimal instruction. In fact, it's probably a hindrance. She got everything organized, looked back at the old data we had. It was a skill she had that, you know, she understood the analysis, what the data was, and how to do the standard analysis. And so she went back at a couple of stations and did a historical comparison across time. So, yeah, those were three wonderful people I got to work with.
Wow.
Exciting people to work with.
That's so inspiring. I feel like I love the acoustic complexity.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be so cool to study and learn about.
we tried to set up a study comparing areas that had controlled burns before and after and with an adjacent control site. Mm-hmm. But they never burned. never. I mean, it was too dry for the 2 years that I was there, and then I think they did burn them last year.
Yeah. Melissa also had a couple of questions, and the question is, like, what makes the soundscape, like, whole or complete?
Complete, I think, is when it's not dominated by human-made, human-caused sounds. Mm. I mean, overflights, vehicles, the intangible version of an undeveloped area, you know, where you don't have buildings, you don't have roads. You look at that and you say, oh, this is complete, this is intact. And the same way for a soundscape. You don't hear a bus going by or a helicopter or an aircraft or a jet overhead. That's what an intact soundscape would be. And it's not necessarily that there's sounds there. I mean, sometimes there's nothing there. So
when you're like listening to a soundscape, other than when you're like listening to study something, how are you personally impacted by soundscapes?
I find it calming.
Mm.
You know, you focus. It's like when you're doing a math problem or something that you're focused on. It's you're using these other tools to study. So, you know, it makes me calm when I'm trying to experience or trying to record in my own head what's going on around me.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
No, yeah, totally. No, yeah, in my soundscape program, mm-hmm. I talk about like noise, how noise impacts humans, mm-hmm. and how it's like only second to air pollution is like the most harmful.
Oh, really?
That's good. What I'm trying to say. Yeah, which I thought was just interesting, yeah. And I, because it's not something we normally think about.
And did you find the study, the visitor use study, where they say that the number one reason for visiting Grand Canyon is to experience the sounds of nature? Mm-hmm. We belong to the Conservancy, and we got the most recent, they have a little magazine that comes out a couple times a year, and one of the articles in there was talking about why people come to Grand Canyon. They listed first soundscapes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It was gratifying.
Yeah. So important. We don't even think about it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's that intangible quality that you need. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do a couple pop-ups where I ask people, like, where is the quietest place they have been?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Some people will say the Grand Canyon, just in comparison to where they've been.
Right.
But some fun answers I've also gotten was scuba diving and Antarctica.
Antarctica. That's a good
one. but yeah, it's just interesting to compare to see, like, where people are coming from, because I think Grand Canyon is kind of a noisy place, or like
it is when you're at the South Rim. I mean, that's when you compare the South and North Rims, it's much less busy on the North Rim, and there's places that you can walk to that aren't quite as busy. I mean, Mather Point, sure, you can see Grand Canyon, but it's really busy. I was thinking about this after we talked, and I was thinking, oh, there's camps, river camps. There's Schist Camp on the river. There's Ledges Camp that are just incredibly quiet. There's no rapids. You're not near a flight corridor, so you're not going to get the air tours in the morning and evening. You'll still hear jets, but they are remarkably quiet, really, really quiet. But you'll still hear, you know, at Ledges, you'll hear a little dripping spring at the way downstream end of camp. But you can have a, you know, indoor voice conversation 50 feet apart from people. it's really cool. Just above Saddle was a research camp we used to go to every year and in the spring. And it had a bunch of trees in the back and a bunch of vegetation all through. And we had one of the great dawn choruses there, the birds waking up in the morning. It was like, oh, this is, after a while you wanted them to shut up. But I'm up, exactly. I'm awake, I get the message.
What is your hope for soundscapes at the Grand Canyon, or just like in general, like in the world?
My hope for soundscapes would be, the Grand Canyon soundscapes would be, that there would be times when there are no air tours overhead. Mm-hmm. You know, they restrict them to, you can't have air tours before half an hour after sunrise. They can't be out there at sunrise while you're enjoying it, or half an hour before sunset. And, you know, I think the park can promote places that have intact soundscapes. Mm. And it would be nice if there were ways to create times when you aren't going to have air tours. I mean, air tours are they're the biggest impact. There's a guy who works for the Sierra Club who wants to have air tour free days, you know, like a Saturday. Twice a year, just no air tours over Desert View, Hermit, whatever, just so people can experience that. And there's more air tours at Grand Canyon than there are, well, a couple of years ago, this was the fact, more air tours at Grand Canyon than there are in the next three NPS units combined. And that's just what comes out of Tucson. That ignores everything that comes out of Grand Canyon West, the tours that come out of Hualapai. The guess is that it's about the same as it is from Tucson. Very busy, about 50,000 a year. You know, it's really heartening to know that somebody is out there doing interpretation, that someone is bringing this to people's attention, because it isn't something you think about, and it isn't something visitors think about. Sure, they say we're here to experience the sounds of nature, but I think you only appreciate that either after the fact or when it's happening to you. So,
right. And like these natural soundscapes are just becoming harder and harder to find.
Harder to find. There are, I was just reading, in Japan, they have the 100 soundscapes of Japan. They have designated places where you can go to hear an intact soundscape.
I guess, what can visitors and other people listening do? How can they positively impact the soundscape for Grand Canyon?
I think that by focusing on it, you know, even if it's just going to the rim and sure you get your view of the rim, close your eyes and listen, you know, and maybe you'll hear people walking around, but, you know, all the other stuff, the sound of the wind, sounds of wildlife. I mean, it's not spring, so you won't hear birds quite so much, but, you know, just the sounds around you, just appreciate that. And if something bothers you, if there is, you know, a something that the park can do to improve, to make the soundscape more intact, don't need to have buses idling. We don't need to have, you know, any sort of other amplified sounds, then write a letter to the park. The park actually, it goes to the superintendent's office, and generally it gets forwarded to whatever division is responsible. But, you know, if the planning division had to start thinking about how to preserve the natural sounds of the park, that would be a great thing.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So, and it only comes from the public.
I have a just thought that last night I was talking to our coworkers. We had Aaron White performing. He's a Native American
fluter.
And I'm really sad I wasn't there. Were you there?
There's,
like, he was saying there was a moment where he was like, I don't get to watch the sunset sometimes. So he turned the whole audience around.
You made to watch the sunset.
Where he played towards the canyon.
Oh, nice.
And I'm curious, like, you know, the like soundscapes, we're talking about like natural soundscapes and things like that, but it sounded like that was like a very different soundscape where people were connecting in a very different way by listening and being in that space. And I'm curious, like, how do, like, not just natural sounds, but maybe like sounds that are always in the canyon or meant to be in the canyon that are that are human, like, how do those play a role into the science too? Because I think that's a big aspect of like balancing like natural versus like human, but it's also like, well, humans have been here since time immemorial, so how do those intermingle, where it's like maybe we're talking more like natural versus like automotive or like
mechanical. The Wilderness Act talks about the difference between, you know, unimproved and, you know, not affected by modern mechanical and mechanized and motorized stuff. And yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, it's like, how do we keep encouraging these like human sounds that are connected to the canyon,
right?
That bring us as humans also closer to one another, but then to space. How cool to hear a flute,
right?
Those inspirational human sounds that are unaffected or not affected much by mechanical sounds and overflights and just conversation, but, you know, kind of the best of what humanity has to offer as far as music and inspiration and things that do connect you to nature. Those can also be a really important part of the experience and the soundscape too. But it is different when it's like, you know, you're still hearing cars and slamming doors and people walking around and honking things, and versus if you're in a place that can really support that experience with nature and experience with human mm-hmm. artistry.
The Behind the Scenery podcast is brought to you by the interpretation team at Grand Canyon National Park. A huge thanks to Mike and Sarah for sharing their experiences and perspectives. We gratefully acknowledge the Native peoples on whose ancestral homelands we gather, as well as the diverse and vibrant Native communities who make their homes here today.